Ultimate Odyssey began in 1979 after he read Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. His immediate reaction after learning of the Great Pyramid's precision and design characteristics was to consider that this edifice may have an original purpose that differed from conventional opinion at the time. Discovering the purpose of this machine, documenting his case, has taken the better part of 20 years of research. Welcome back to Coast, Christopher Dunn. Christopher, welcome back.
Hello, George. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Likewise. I'm looking forward to this. And, of course, Brian Forrester, born in Rochester, Minnesota, but grew up on the west coast of Canada at the age of 11. He became fascinated with the native art of the Haida native people and began carving totem poles and other related art forms, and learning from native teachers in Peru, and the study of the Inca culture became his next major area of interest. Here's Brian Forrester. Hello, Brian. Nice to have you with us.
Absolutely. My pleasure, George. Thank you.
And you're out there in Peru right now, are you?
Yes, sir. I'm in Lima right now.
How are things out there for people who have never been there, Brian?
The weather is quite wonderful in Lima. I was actually in Cusco yesterday for about a week, and there it's more like Vancouver kind of weather. It's kind of rainy, but it's green and lush, and it's the land of the Inca, so I love it very much.
Well, good. You're sounding clear, and it's good to have you with us. And, Christopher, always a pleasure to have you on the show, my friend.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, George.
And your theories of the Giza power plant still, I think, keeps people baffled. I mean, let me ask you very briefly, Christopher, how did you come up with that theory?
It was actually, you know, it was Tompkins' book and the questions that were raised by a lot of earlier researchers. And it seemed that the common thread that ran through a lot of the earlier explorers and researchers, that it was to question the original purpose that has been taught by Egyptologists, that it was built as a tomb. And so there were a lot of different ideas presented in this book. And the book ended with a huge question mark, and that question mark was, what actually was the Great Pyramid? Will we ever be able to figure it out? And as I was researching and reading the book, a light bulb came off or came on over my head, and it was quite a radical idea that I pursued for over 20 years, and then finally published my theory in the Giza power plant in 1998. But it took a lot of time, a lot of research, and a lot of study and thought about the different elements within the Great Pyramid. And so for that, it was a very satisfying and really right now, as we are 12 years down the road from when the Giza power plant was published, it doesn't seem to have slowed down as far as the amount of interest in it and the supporters of it. And indeed, as we may talk later, the evidence keeps rolling in that to actually support the theory, and other research that other people are engaged in also support the theory. So who knows? I mean, one of these days we may be able to get to turn it on.
Maybe so. And what are your thoughts, Christopher, on Zahi Hawass's fall from grace?
I think in that area of the world, it's not an unusual event. I'm surprised that he was able to last as long as he did. But then, when you consider how close he was to Mubarak, particularly Mrs. Mubarak, then it's understandable because it's more of connections and politics. But as far as what that will do in terms of the archaeology, or at least the popularization of discoveries and the broadcasting of discoveries, he was a great showman, and he certainly kept things stirred up and entertained and also angered a lot of people in the process.
Yeah, that's so true, so true. Let's bring Brian back in. Brian, tell me about your work in Peru.
Well, basically, my work started, my interest started about 6 years ago. As you said, I was fascinated from childhood with the native people of the west coast of Canada. I became a professional totem pole carver and carver of other objects. When I was about 35, I moved to Hawaii and helped build a 62-foot double-hull sailing canoe, traditional, and then returned to Canada. And for some reason, about 6 years ago, I became fascinated with the Inca and Machu Picchu, so I came down to visit, and it just grabbed my attention. And I've been coming to Peru ever since, having moved here June of last year.
Ian, what can you tell us about the Inca, Brian?
Well, the basic story is that the Inca left the area of Lake Titicaca about 950 A.D. as the result of a 40-year drought. And so traditional archaeology says that they established Cusco about 1100 or 1200 A.D. But the more that I do research, the more that I'm finding the case is similar to in Egypt, where some of the structures in Cusco, the stone buildings, especially those that you can't fit a piece of paper or a human hair in between the joints, are probably thousands of years older than the Inca. And the more that I study the oral traditions, the more evidence that I'm finding that that was the case.
How did the Inca differ from the Maya, if at all?
They're completely separate cultures. There's no real relationship between the two.
None at all. Okay. No similarities, nothing like that?
No, not really.
Okay. In your work in Peru, and, you know, it is, I have been told, just a fascinating place. When you look at the structures that they've got, and much like, of course, when we'll talk with Christopher about Egypt later on as well, how do you think they made these structures?
Well, the theory that I'm developing more and more is that the Inca, when they reached Cusco, that Cusco was actually an abandoned city. And that's what intrigued them, because it seemed more logical to me that they would build their city in the nearby Sacred Valley, because it's much more productive in terms of agriculture and the climate's better. But what I think, based upon my recent trip with Dr. Arlen Andrews, is that they had like an intuitive knowledge or an ancestral knowledge that Cusco was the homeland. And as they approached the city of Cusco, they found this massive megalithic gate, and the road between Lake Titicaca and Cusco had already been there for probably thousands of years prior to their existence. And so they simply entered Cusco and were in awe of the fact that there were these huge quadrangular or buildings made out of stone, where the stone fits so well together that, like I say, you can't fit a human hair in between them, and they're still intact today.
So what about... I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead. Brian.
So they decided to establish their city there because that is the city that the ancient people, the ancient megalithic builders, had built.
What about tools, Brian?
Well, that's the funny thing. Conventional archaeology states that, and it's proven in the archaeological record, that the only tools that the Inca had were bronze chisels and stone hammers. And again, buildings such as the Coricancha, which was not only the spiritual center, but also the political center of the Inca, is so finely made that you, again, can't fit a human hair in between. And it's impossible for them to have built that building with bronze chisels and stone hammers.
There's no way, but any idea how they did it?
Well, the more that I share photographs with people like Chris, and with Stephen Mailer, and with other experts, the theory that we're starting to develop is that they had some kind of vibrational technology in, you know, several thousand years ago that we don't even have today. So it's very much an out-of-the-box kind of approach.
Chris, are you at that point where you believe this too?
Well, I think from my visits there, and of course I have been fascinated with South America for many years, and I finally had the opportunity to go there in 2005 with David Hatcher Childress, a good friend of yours.
Yes.
And so in 2005, when I visited Cusco and went along the Passage Agua Pinta, it's kind of an alleyway by a monastery, and saw some of the megalithic stones. That was my first encounter with the difference in the architectural styles, where you have the megalithic construction, where the stones are multifaceted and fitted together with great precision, just as Brian said. But then when you look at the repairs that were made, they're very primitive. I have some photographs up on my website if folks want to click on the link, Mysteries of Peru and Bolivia Revealed, then they can go through and look at some of those photographs. But you'll see the differences in style, where you have the what seems to be the earlier culture, what would be the earlier culture, and then the primitive or rough kind of repairs that have been made. But then as you go through all the other different sites in Peru, such as Ayantitambo and even Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman, you see the lower portion of the construction is made out of these huge megalithic blocks, finely fitted. And then on top of them, you have the smaller elements, the size that you may find in a modern building, just put together like a dry stone wall in some cases, and in Cusco, which I believe the repairs are more modern, they use some kind of a mortar between the stones, which the Inca didn't use, or the pre-Inca, as we are now coming to believe. We're not using any mortar between the joints because the stones were so perfectly fitted together.
So you're saying, though, that the earlier civilizations were more advanced than the later ones?
It's the same story in Peru and Bolivia that we find in Egypt, and that is that the ancient cultures were able to do really remarkable work with a high level, high degree of precision, using multi-ton, over 100 tons in Peru and Bolivia, and over 1,000 tons when we go to Egypt. But the geometry and precision in the Egypt is it's not quite the same in Peru. You do have the megalithic construction with the finely fitted joints, but it's not till you get to Bolivia that you start to see the geometric precision that is the hallmark of Egyptian construction. So in Peru, though, I mean, it's a beautiful place to go. I was really inspired by going there, and I actually went back in 2011, and it was even more inspiring then because, you know, one of the things that I try to do is to connect with the ancient culture in some way, or try to get inside the ancient stone maker's head and say, okay, what were you doing here, guys, you know? and you know, attempt to figure out exactly how they were making these structures. And so the last trip I had, it was quite inspiring to me because I think I was kind of tuning into perhaps some of the methods. I mean, everybody has a theory. There are all kinds of theories out there. But the interesting thing that I noted was that, particularly at Sacsayhuaman, it appeared to me that the area, there was a massive upheaval. You have an extrusive mound or extrusive rock that actually pushed up through the bedrock. They call it the Inca Slide, and there are deep gouges on this slide. They're quite smooth because for centuries people have been using it to play on. I mean, if you go there today, you'll find children sliding down it. even old children like Brian and myself. But the but the Inca slide, I think, actually gives us a an indicator of perhaps where the blocks came from to build the megalithic structure. If you consider that if this extrusive rock was pushing up through the Earth's mantle and then breaking through the bedrock, then it could have broken off pieces that would be fitted together like a jigsaw puzzle. So it's a matter of just blowing up a jigsaw puzzle, and then what they did was put the pieces together to build the walls. That's just an idea. It would actually simplify the problem of actually making this thing, because what you find with all the joints is no two blocks are the same. Common to all the blocks is that they're not built like a modern building, where you have essentially layers. So, you know, you may have a layer of stone that is horizontal, which that form of construction could shake apart in an earthquake. But the Inca construction, all the stones seem to be interlocking in such a way that they can't move. I mean, if you were able to push a wall one direction, the stones would stick together. You know, if you try to pull it apart, they're bound together by their geometry and by their precision.
Amazing. And Brian, let me ask you this: when we talk about lost cities, how many are we talking about? Do we know?
Well, we don't really know. Of course, people think of Machu Picchu as the lost city, which it was, because the Spanish never found it. But there's another one called Choqquequirau, which is less than 100 miles away, and it's not quite as big as Machu Picchu, but almost the same size. The Spanish didn't find it. People have been looking for more than 100 years for a place called Paititi, which they think was the place where the Inca were able to hide most of the gold prior to the Spanish conquest. And no one so far has found it, except last week when I was there with Arlen Andrews, our taxi driver, who happens to be a Quechua person, a native person of the area. He said he knows where it is, and he said he would take me there.
How about that? Well, that's fascinating stuff. Now, when you go to these areas, how do they get lost? Vegetation just overtake them?
Basically, the thing is that any lost city is probably somewhere on the ancient Inca road system. So Machu Picchu, for example, is on a side route off of one of the major Inca highways. So a lot of people are thinking that deep in the Amazon somewhere there would be this, you know, shining city, but you have to take into account the material. Cusco and the Sacred Valley and even around Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, you know, there is a lot of stone, so you could build, many giant stone buildings, whereas in the Amazon you don't have that much stone. So I'm looking more closer to Cusco and the Sacred Valley area for signs of ancient lost cities.
All right, hold on, Brian. We're going to be back with you and Christopher Dunn in just a moment as we talk about these ancient civilizations right here on Coast to Coast AM.
To talk about the issues that
come.
Chris, after studying Egypt for so many years, what got you to turn your attention to South America?
That's a very good question. I always wanted to go to Machu Picchu. I thought that was, that fascinated me. And the only photographs that I'd seen were the famous ones of Machu Picchu and other sites like Sacsayhuaman, Ollantaytambo. My thoughts was that I probably wouldn't find the same degree of craftsmanship there that I would in Egypt. So it wasn't a real passion of mine to go. I was interested in going, and when I had the opportunity, I took it. And so I was very surprised with what was found there, what I was able to see there. But at the time I went, it was with Dave Childress, and we were actually making a video. And, of course, David, he was hot on the trail of ancient machining in Peru and Bolivia. And so we were going around on, checking these different artifacts, and there were checking, these stones, and mm-hmm. I wasn't finding the same precision, the same geometric precision. And so when he asked me the question, well, don't you think this has been machined? And I would answer, well, that's not a, the best evidence to actually support such an idea. And so we'd move on to another site, and so the question was the same at every site. Well, obviously this has been machined, and I am probably more conservative than a lot of people in this field. I was very hesitant to actually come out and say positively that, yeah, they had to have used machines to do this. Now, one of the things that I do believe, though, I became aware of, that was that they were obviously moving very heavy blocks around, megalithic yeah. blocks, with relative ease, much like the other ancient cultures, like in Egypt or in Lebanon at Baalbek. Mm-hmm. That part of it, to me, was of great interest. And, if you look at some of the megalithic blocks at Sacsayhuaman, and you see the way they are so tightly fitted, you have to wonder, how were they lifting these up? How were they trimming them to fit? Because if they were using simple hand tools, and they would have to actually put a block on top of another one and fit it together, take it off again, trim it off where you have the high spots so that you remove the imperfections until you finally get a perfect fit.
And put it back on again.
Do that. And then put it back on again. And how often would they have to do that? And when you look at the size of these stones, it seems almost impossible to believe that a primitive culture, a simple culture, without the tools, without even the technology that we have the way we lift megalithic elements, it would be an impossible mission. And the conventional theory about how the supposed Incas built this place is that they used mud ramps. I mean, they don't even allow them the benefits of using log rollers,
right.
Because it is a high elevation, and the trees are not very plentiful, and perhaps according to conventional wisdom, they hadn't figured out how to use a wooden roller, but they used these earthen ramps and dragged the stones into place.
Are you familiar, Christopher, with the work of Edward Leete Scanlon from Coral Castle?
Well, George, I'd have a full chapter on Edward Leete Scanlon in my book, The Giza Power Plant.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only man, in modern times anyway, to say he knew how the pyramids of Egypt were built and actually performed some work that proved that he was probably right. Ed was an eccentric. He was from Latvia, a Latvian immigrant, and essentially he lived alone in Florida, South Florida, at a homestead, and they built this castle out of coral. He was moving 30-ton blocks of stone, coral, and he wouldn't allow anybody to watch him work. He was very, very reclusive, very secretive about, and there's lots of legends about, and, you know, anecdotes about how people were peering over the wall and seeing him float stones in the air. And, but, you know, those are kind of, that's, you know, kind of the, it's not the best evidence, you know, to just have an oral kind of, interesting legend about somebody, but he was definitely mysterious. I think that Ed Lee Scanlon had developed a technique that alleviated the effects of gravity on heavy objects and was able to do it with relative ease. And I think that when he said that that's how the ancient Egyptians did it, how he was able to make that connection is, I don't know, but he certainly was able to demonstrate something. We have the results of what he did. He didn't demonstrate it to anybody, but the results definitely would indicate that this guy knew what he was talking about.
Yeah, he may have had those secrets. Yeah, I do too. Is it possible, let's get you, Brian, and you, Christopher, is it possible that they had high-impact lasers which allowed them to cut the stone, Brian?
Well, the thing is that Chris has proven that that isn't the case because he actually showed it on Ancient Aliens. He took a sample of ancient stone, and he did a comparison test of cutting with a laser, cutting with a grinder, and then also having the original surface. And he did a microscopic study of that, which is available on Facebook to look at. And lasers actually melt stone, but they make a complete mess. The mystery about the megalithic builders of Peru is the fact that all of the cuts are very clean, and any place that where you find a 90-degree angle, there's actually a curve. So these huge cubes of stone, some is the size of refrigerators, are literally cut out of solid bedrock, and some of them even appear to be polished, or at least the surface is so clean that I can't figure out, and I've never found anybody who can figure out how the stone was removed. But lasers are not a candidate.
Okay, Chris, as you look at that with you know, getting lasers out of the picture, they must have had something. They had to have had something.
Yes, they had to have had something, and you know that's what the mystery is. What kind of tools did they have? And you know, as far as the laser is concerned, that has been a popular theory for so long. And having been involved in high energy laser processing in my work for many years, I took the opportunity. Brian sent me a piece of a stone, the same kind of stone that you would find at Pumapunku, and it did have an ancient cut on it, and it's posted on my website, and you can see the differences in the cuts. And the cut that the laser did, it's not conventional cutting. It's more burning because it is a thermal process.
Right.
And it actually turns the surface into glass. You have it melts it, but then you have a remelt layer and a heat affected zone, which is a signature of thermal processing, like with laser or plasma arc and things of that nature. So it's a thermal process, pure and simple. And you don't produce the same kind of surface with it that you do with conventional tools. Now, the other part of that is that a laser works better if it's penetrating completely through the material. And you can't stop the laser. I mean, you can stop it just by not having enough energy to penetrate the laser, but then you don't get anything but blobs on the surface of the material that you're working with. You can't stop it. I mean, you can't really set a depth. So when you look at some of the cuts that you find in Peru, Bolivia, in Egypt, and you see these cavities that are cut or corners, when a laser is put to work, it has to pass right through the material. Otherwise, it's not efficient.
Well, let's assume for a second that the technology, the lost technology, we'll get into why it may have been lost, but that it was similar then in different regions of this planet a long, long time ago. How can we explain that? The fact that it was happening in Egypt, it was happening in Peru, possibly Bolivia, maybe Lebanon. It was planet-wide. How come, Christopher?
Well, I think that, you know, just like today, there is a cross-pollination of technologies, ideas that move from culture to culture. I don't agree with the conventional theories that these ancient cultures were not communicating with each other. I mean, you just see some of the Negroid heads that you find in South America and some of the other different shaped skulls that Brian has studied. And you can see that there is a wide variety of different peoples that were migrating or, you know, in transit through these different places. We, as engineers, go all over the world and lend our skills to different places, building and actually teaching. That's how technology has flourished, and why now a lot of the technologies that we developed in the West were adopted in Japan and China and around the Pacific Rim. And so the manufacturing genie is out of the bottle, and everybody can manufacture now, whereas at one time all the manufacturing technologies were closely held secrets.
All right, how about your thoughts, Brian? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Chris.
No, that's fine. Brian certainly can add to that.
Well, the thing is that a number of people have sent me photographs, especially from the west coast of Italy, where the Etruscans used to live. And you see the same thing. You'll see these large, these huge boulders or even bedrock exposed stones where you have stairways that seem to go nowhere. And they look almost exactly the same as what we see in Peru and to some extent Bolivia. And so I definitely believe there was a global culture, possibly a pre-Ice Age ending culture that existed around the world. David Hatcher Childress was actually the first person to tell me about that. And so I think, along with what Graham Hancock talks about, a period of amnesia, is that there was a high culture that lived around the world. The Ice Age ended. There was possibly a 3,000-year period of amnesia of people because of the devastating effects of a possible change in the tilt of the planet because of a meteor impact or a comet coming close by, according to the theories of Stephen Mailer and also Barbara Han Clow. And so civilization had to start again. And I think what we're looking at in Peru, Egypt and Italy and other places is a very ancient, sophisticated culture that we are only starting to re-recognize today.
That's a good point. Now, is it possible it's much older than we think?
Well, you know, if you look at the time period that people like Graham Hancock and Barbara Han Clow were looking at, as in 11,500 B.C. or 11,500 years ago for this catastrophe to have happened, then then obviously you're looking at structures that were made by a sophisticated culture more than 12,000 years ago. How far back in time we can go, I'm hoping to find out to some degree with Chris and also Dr. Robert Schock in November, because he's coming down to join me and a megalithomania group from England to research that.
Well, that could be amazing. You know, in the old Indian texts, they talk about flying machines, Vermanas, that they were out there. I mean, this planet might have been loaded with high technology.
Exactly. And, of course, what the archaeologist is saying is always, where are the tools? But what we're finding, again, thanks to people like Stephen Mailer, are seemingly components of tools in, for example, the Cairo Museum, where you have these amazing, almost perfectly circular discs made out of very thin schist stone. And they could be components of machines. And what I'm always telling people is, if any ancient machine existed that had anything of value, such as gold or silver, a later culture that wasn't as sophisticated would simply take those machines apart and recycle them.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Gosh, I would have loved to have lived in that era just for a moment, Brian, just to see what they were doing.
Well, exactly. And I think what we have to do is, that's why people keep saying laser, because most people are thinking in terms of the technology that we understand, but it's quite possible that a like ancient culture would have used a completely different mindset. So that's why different people are thinking now in terms of vibrational tools or sound tools, something of, you know, science fiction that we think of, but they could have actually existed.
Well, absolutely. And Chris, tell us a little bit about these measurements you took in Peru and your comparison to Egypt.
When I was there in 2005, my measurements were rather limited because of the range of tools that I took. But when I was going through Peru, the tools that I did have, which was a straight edge and a square, were quite adequate, and I did find some extremely flat surfaces in various locations, such as Ayantitambo. Not so much in Machu Picchu or Sacsayhuaman, but Ayantitambo did have some stones that were extremely flat. But it was very interesting. I had some other tools in my toolkit, but when we went to Bolivia and took a day trip out to Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, I had left most of them in my hotel, because I didn't think I would need them. I thought that I would see just pretty much what I had seen previously, and so there were some tools that I left behind. That all kind of changed when I went to Pumapunku, and immediately I realized that I made a huge mistake, because there were artifacts that there's only way you could describe them, and that is that they were cut on a machine, because of the precision of them, the geometry, and it's totally different, not at all like what I saw in Peru. So it was a very interesting story. We arrive at Pumapunku, Tiwanaku village, and we stay at the hotel Tiwanaku. Visited Pumapunku that afternoon. And then I hired a taxi driver to take me back to La Paz so that I could get the tools that I'd left behind and take some more measurements.
All right, but, with you two. We're going to take this break, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about this, including, of course, some of the lost technologies of Bolivia. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM with our guest Brian Forrester, Christopher Dunn on Coast to Coast AM.
Never miss a detail on a show or a guest. Sign up for the Coast Zone email newsletter, available for free at coasttocoastam.com.
Brian, the difference, if any, Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, what's the difference? Is there one?
I think so. I think Pumapunku actually is older, and it's better much finer work than Tiwanaku, because Pumapunku, unfortunately, we only find possibly 5 or 10% of what originally was there, because the stone was recycled since the time of the first Spanish, and they built buildings in the little village of Tiwanaku and also in La Paz out of it. Chris was saying, the surfaces are perfectly flat. I went there with David Childress, and we had steel rulers that we put on the surface and moved them back and forth, and you couldn't see any daylight. So obviously those were machined, whereas Tiwanaku I find a little bit cruder. So I think Pumapunku is older and more sophisticated.
Why do you think it was built, Brian?
David and I have an agreement that we think that it was built by some mysterious people as some kind of factory for processing ore, because it's so high up in elevation, close to the Andes, where there's a lot of gold and silver and copper, that some mysterious people, I think, built it as some kind of facility to process and then abandoned it. And it was later adopted by a culture who decided to turn it into a temple.
Your thoughts, Chris?
I think the Pumapunku, to me, was probably more like a citadel or a fortress, based on my analysis of the H blocks. It seems to me that there was a definitely a construction purpose for it. As far as the ore smelting plant or processing plant, I haven't really studied that theory too much. I'm not sure if there's any literature on what may have been found as far as slag in the area or, other kind of industrial waste that you would find with such an operation. But the definitely there are many elements there that could go into a building a very substantial fortress.
Interesting. Go ahead.
As Brian mentioned, the flat surfaces at Pumapunku are incredible when you consider the time period that we're looking at and the supposed technology that these ancient people had. And it kind of reminds me of when I went into the Serapeum, or even into the Second Pyramid in Egypt, and actually check the flatness of the inside of the so-called sarcophagus, and then in the Serapeum, these huge granite boxes with that had such a high level of precision on the inside that they actually scream out technology, machining, very, very special purpose for them. But the flat surface is really, it wasn't common in ancient times, particularly something that is as precise as the blocks that we find at Pumapunku. And also, Brian, there are some at Tiwanaku, some very precise, very flat surfaces at Tiwanaku. So, as far as whether they are contemporaneous, I can't really make that determination, but we do see the similarities. But it's really unusual geometries at Pumapunku that make it stand out. Now, as far as the why you would create a flat surface like that, if you don't have, we didn't start creating flat surfaces like that until there was a need for them, and that need was actually founded in the Industrial Revolution, where we needed flat surfaces in order to create machines that where you would have elements or members that would slide along a surface, and that surface had to be flat, otherwise the product you were making, whether it was on a lathe or on a mill, would not be accurate. So those flat surfaces came in later on in the West, as far as a need for that kind of precision. At Pumapunku, there is a series of photographs on my website. It's if you actually click on the link there, Mysteries of Peru and Bolivia Revealed, there is a series of photographs towards the bottom, and it's right below the it's like right below the laser cut object. And I took a dial indicator, which is an instrument that we use in manufacturing to take comparative measures on a surface plate. And the surface plate is an example of a flat surface that we would use in manufacturing. And we use that to create a datum from which we measure very, very precise manufactured items, such as in the shop I work at, turbine parts, gas turbine parts that go in jet engines and things of that nature, and the tools that actually are created to make them. So this instrument had a resolution of 0.5 tenths of an inch, or half a thousandth of an inch, which, you know, if you consider what the academics say about these ancient cultures, such as the Incas, they didn't even have a plumb bob, let alone a surface gauge. And then here I am in Bolivia with a surface gauge and passing it along a block, an ancient block that's thousands of years old, and it's less than half a thousandth of an inch. The needle on the gauge only moved less than a half thousandth of an inch. I tried it, but I there was another observer, Jay Wakefield, who was along on the trip, and so, you know, he obviously, I mean, I do like to have other people verify my work, and it's always best to have actually somebody do it, because, you know, a lot of times you can say, oh, well, you know, you actually controlled the gauge, and you had it read what you wanted it to believe, want it to read, and so or you may have changed it when you took your photograph. But no, he took the gauge, and he passed the gauge along the piece of rock, and around in a 360 degree arc, and across that 360 degree arc, which was probably, I would say, a 16-inch circle. That gauge, that dial indicator, didn't move hardly at all, less than a half thousandth of an inch, which is absolutely incredible.
Well, it is remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, it's a smoking gun. It's like, you know, going into a place in Egypt and finding the same thing, and it's a smoking gun, because there's absolutely no need for a building block to be that precise. You know, the interesting thing was that I was on a tour with a group of people in 2011, and I had this gauge, and so what I wanted to do was actually have a show and tell with the guests the night before. Mm-hmm. And so we met in the suite at the Ritz Hotel in La Paz, a very beautiful place to stay. You know, and the Ritz Hotel is a very nice hotel, 5-star hotel. But they had a glass table, and I was trying to teach the guests how to read verniers and inside micrometers and then use the surface gauge. So we cleared everything off the table, and I had my tools on the table, right? And I took the indicator on this manufactured tabletop, which was made of glass, and I passed it from the center to the edge, and it displaced the indicator dial 7/1000ths of an inch.
Jeez.
And this is on a modern manufactured item.
Yeah.
And so then the next day we're off to Bolivia, and we find it within less than half a thousandth of an inch. And a half a thousandth of an inch is 1/5 the thickness of a human hair.
Well, is it possible, and let me get you on this, Brian, because you talked about the possibility of this calamity, which caused people to, you know, get some temporary amnesia and people weren't around to pass on this information. Is it possible civilizations could be not 11,500 years ago, but maybe millions of years ago, as Michael Cremo believes?
I'm not, you know, I personally think that's pushing it too far, but I can easily see that there was a very advanced culture. Some call it Atlantis, which I think is a name. I don't believe in the concept of a continent sinking in the ocean. But, of course, once the Ice Age ended, the sea level around the world rose by 350 feet. And that might be an oral tradition which has to be interpreted as poetry, not literally. So when they say that the continent sank, it might simply mean that the sea level rose. And one little point I wanted to make with Chris, though, is that I don't think of Pumapunku as a place. I think of it as a time period. And so that's why around Tiwanaku, you find things that are very similar to Pumapunku. But I think Pumapunku was the first site that occupied all of Tiwanaku. And then devastation happened, reclamation and recycling happened, and then a later culture came and built Tiwanaku there. Because I found the exact same stones that you find in terms of precision at, that you find at Pumapunku scattered in piles, almost like refuse piles around Tiwanaku.
What are the names, Pumapunku?
That's a sensible idea, yeah.
Thanks.
What do the names mean, Brian?
Well, Pumapunku, puma, of course, is an animal. It's a large cat.
Yeah.
And punku means gate, so it's the gate of the puma. Tiwanaku is an Aymara word, and I'm actually not quite sure what the name means, because the problem is that that area of Lake Titicaca, it's a mix of the Aymara culture and the Quechua culture.
Now, Pumapunku is in ruins, unlike some of the other areas, right?
Oh, exactly. Like I say, there's maybe 5% of Pumapunku left, because if you visit the nearby village, you'll see even in the church this very specific gray stone, which some people call diorite, but it's not a true diorite. You'll see that that the people who built the church there in the 16th century built it out of Pumapunku stone, because you see these precision holes in it, the flat surfaces and things. So that's the very sad thing about Pumapunku, is that very little of it still exists. But even if we only had two pieces, both of those pieces show the precision that Chris has been talking about, which is astonishingly sophisticated.
Sure is. And what more needs to be investigated out there, Chris?
Well, there is quite a lot. You know, the like Brian said, there's a lot missing. There's a tremendous amount missing. But I think that when we go back in August, we're taking a group down in August to Peru and Bolivia. But I will be looking. I want to actually examine the church in Tiwanaku and look at the Pumapunku stones that made it there. When I went there in 2011, I was looking for evidence that these stones actually were interlocking or fitted together through an interlocking system, because they have these geometric protrusions from the rock, and it looks like perhaps a protrusion on one rock would slide into a recess on another rock. And the other thing that I was looking for was manufacturing precision, where you would find that the dimensions of some of these geometric elements were the same from rock to rock. So that was the nature of my investigation in 2011. And what I found was I was astounded by it, and I was totally surprised, because most of the drawings or information that I had read about Pumapunku showed that the recesses on these famous H blocks now, I think they've become quite famous since Ancient Aliens, but these H blocks have these recesses in them, and they appear to be parallel. and they appear to be the same from one block to the next. And so when I went there in 2011, I took a range of instruments that would allow me to actually measure the dimensions from one block to the other to see if they were the same. And if they were, that would definitely speak to the use of manufacturing equipment, machines that would be consistent in creating the same kind of block. And also, there was another theory out there that these blocks were poured into molds. And so that was another part of the investigation, was to see if there was any merit to that idea. And my dimensions that I took on the inside of these recesses, I was able to examine four of these recesses. And what I found was that each one was different. And the interesting thing is, and what amazed me, was that the front of the opening of these recesses was smaller than the back. So they were actually like dovetails, where you have dimensions that are getting larger as you go deeper into the rock. That was quite a discovery for me, because it was like, well, why would they do such a thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had to have done it intentionally. And then I started to inspect other parts of these blocks, and I find that there are other elements of the blocks that were not square either. So you would expect that if you had an orthogonal machine where the axes moved rectangular to each other or perpendicular to each other, that you would find squareness in the corners or along the surfaces from one surface to the other. And that's not the case in these H blocks, which was quite puzzling to me. So the only conclusion that I could come up with was that they were the dovetails were used to lock into place another piece. So there was another detail that was actually locked into place in these dovetails. Now, what could that be? That was the question. And like I was mentioning earlier, I try to connect and still my mind and put away all preconceived notions and try and connect with the ancients. And at 3 o'clock one morning, I woke up, and just in the half dream state, it came to me that they were actually hinge blocks, and that these recesses locked into place the hinges. And
like Legos, almost, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and then when you consider that the way we build hinges today, and the way we install them into buildings, we use screws and bolts and something with a thread that threads through into a piece of wood or something. But in the ancient times, the screw is a fairly modern invention, and it didn't, it wasn't prevalent in industrial use until the Industrial Revolution, and as far as being readily available in hardware stores, well, there weren't any hardware stores, so that's a modern phenomenon. But the screw is relatively new. It's just over 100 years old. The Phillips screw wasn't invented until the 1950s.
Well, they had to improvise, Chris. We're going to come back and talk about elongated skulls and more on Egypt when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
I'd have to stop my journey across America. I'd never get to visit Collinsville, Illinois, and see the world's largest bottle of ketchup. Well, there's no way I'm going to miss that.
For a free rate quote, visit geico.com to see how much you could save. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let's start with you, Brian, about these elongated skulls. Where are they on this planet?
Well, that's something that David Hatcher Childress and I have been researching. He and I just published a book in February about the global phenomenon of cranial deformation, and that occurred in Iraq, in Egypt, in South America, amongst the Olmecs in Melanesia. It was a global phenomenon, most commonly about 1500 BC. And so what we tried to do with the book is to see if there were relationships between these different people. And what we found out was that that seemed to be the case, but predominantly it seemed to happen in Peru, and more specifically the area where I live, which is called Paracas. In Paracas specifically, these people died out at least 2,000 years ago. We have no idea how far back in time they go, and that presently is my research.
Okay, so now explain what these elongated skulls look like, Brian.
Okay, well, actually, most people have seen them on Ancient Aliens and other TV shows.
Right.
Suggesting that they're alien people, alien beings, or hybrid humans. So what they are is the head is distended, and I guess Dan Aykroyd came up with the term cone head. They're very cone-head-looking people. That's also the term that Lloyd Pye, who I'm working with, refers to them.
Okay, now, how did they make them elongated?
Well, the subject of the book with David was that this was done by deformation, which means that it was like a religious ritual practice by binding the skull from childhood to make them look as though they are eventually this cone head, appearance. But the more research I'm doing suggests that the cranial deformation is actually the latest phase, and that farther back in time, that there were natural people, or people who naturally looked that way. Because all the cultures that I've been studying, in their oral traditions, they say that the reason why they would bind the skull of the children, and it was always the nobility, was because they wanted the child to look like the ancestors.
What about some kind of alien intervention theory from above?
Well, I come from a scientific background, but I am starting to lean towards that. I think, especially in Paracas, where we have these huge skulls, some of them, the average human being today is about, the cranial volume is about 1.2 liters.
Yeah.
And some of these are, and I've measured them, are 1.5 and 1.8 liters in size. So the brains themselves were larger, much larger than modern humans. Some people have suggested that, no, it's simply cranial manipulation and that there were air pockets inside of the skulls. But I've done analysis of actual skulls, and I've seen where the brain tissue touches the interior. So these ancient people did have brains which were much larger than ours are.
So are you tipping, Brian, to the possibility that they could have been influenced by ETs?
Yes, I am. And actually, working with Lloyd Pye, we're moving towards that. Again, coming from a scientific background, I don't like to speculate too much, but it is suggesting that the most ancient of these people were not necessarily human. And the DNA testing that we're doing is suggesting that as well, because we've done preliminary DNA testing. The same geneticist that is analyzing the Paracas skulls is the one who has been studying the Star Child. And he's he believes, so far, that you know, the thing is that he's doing it for free. And so the only way to keep him interested would be the fact that there are not human genomes in the DNA sequences. And that's what he's starting to find out. He's quite puzzled and he's quite pleased. And I actually got an email from Lloyd about 2 hours ago saying that the geneticist definitely wants to continue testing in order to find out exactly who these people were or beings.
What's your take on this, Chris?
Well, I think it's definitely a fascinating subject. It's not my subject, but, you know, it's one that I have been close to with my friends like Brian and Lloyd and David. So I find it fascinating. I don't really have anything to add to the discussion, really. But it does. I mean, the mystery to me is that it's an unknown subject. I mean, the existence of these skulls, the history of them. That is the most fascinating to me.
It is. Well, it is. There's no doubt. But you know, you in the past, you haven't been too enthusiastic about the alien intervention theory. Are you changing?
Well, you know, here's my take on that. I think that there is a huge question mark regarding our origins and our history. And there are many different ideas and theories about the nature of ancient people and where they got this technology. I mean, there is a huge question mark. It does leave room for those kind of speculations, particularly when you find incredible accomplishments, the stonework and the precision, the geometry, and there's nothing in the historical record, the archaeological record, to explain it. So where did it come from? Now, as far as my involvement in the ancient aliens, it's like, you know, I'm going to be speaking at the Yuga conference near Sacramento at the end of May, and I know nothing about the Yugas, but they seem to be interested in my work and believe that it may add value to, you know, their particular understanding of that the cycle of the Yugas in terms of were the Egyptians at the same level as the Indians, or were the Indians at the same level as the Egyptians
right.
at that period in time? But as I said, I know nothing about the Yugas. I'm just there to present my data. And when people who are ancient alien believers want me to speak to them about what I found in Egypt and in Peru, I'm more than happy to do that. But my, I still have that question mark in the back of my mind about the nature of ancient people, their ability to move or travel around the planet, the evidence that we see of artifacts that appear to resemble modern astronauts,
mm-hmm.
and you know, on the one side you could say that they were extraterrestrials, they were not from this planet, they came to this planet with their technology, and people, the indigenous people of the air at the time, crafted these effigies to them. And you know, I mean, there's a lot of strong support for that. And you know, in the back of my mind, I think that, you know, well, we're taking modern icons of space travel, such as, you know, the astronaut in the helmet, but they were terrestrial developments, not extraterrestrial developments. So you know, the question in my mind is, could it be that they did have space flight. They were a spacefaring civilization. But was the technology developed on this planet and not off this planet? So I think those two questions are valid. I lean more towards the terrestrial development rather than the extraterrestrial development. But you know that, George. We've talked many times
yes.
about that. And the Ancient Aliens folks know that too. So, I mean, but, you know, I'm quite happy to talk to anybody, you know, regardless of what their belief are.
Christopher, what's new in the world of Egypt? Anything out there that you've been studying?
Well, George, there has been some exciting developments, particularly for my work, if you want to talk about that briefly.
Yeah, please.
As you recall, there was a lot of excitement in 2002 leading up to an exploration that was broadcast live across the planet, and it garnered about 30 million viewers in the U.S., and it was opening of the Lost Tombs live with Zahi Hawass, where they went up the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, drilled a hole in the famous Ganton Brinks door, which is really a small limestone plate at the end of an 18-inch square shaft, and poked a camera behind there and came up with very little.
Yes.
So it was kind of like an anticlimax, right?
It was a little like Al Capone's vault.
It seemed to be, yeah. Where's the mummy? There wasn't one. And there wasn't much of anything else. But as you recall, I went out there and I predicted that they would find a continuation of the copper, or if it is copper, nobody knows if it's copper, but the copper fittings or metal fittings that protruded through that limestone block. And that, according to the Giza power plant theory, they were used as electrodes.
Yes.
And so it was, I think we talked right before the show aired, about what may be found behind Ganton Brink's door when they finally penetrated it. Well, that was quite widely broadcast and promoted. But interestingly enough, very quietly, at the beginning of next year, and perhaps it was because Zahi Hawass didn't want to gather too much attention or gain too much attention to himself because of some of the political problems that were developing in the country, as you recall, the Arab Spring.
Sure.
In January, a new team actually built another robot and went up that shaft. And the camera that they poked through the hole was able to wrap around or turn around and look back on the back of the limestone block or the Ganton Brinks door that has been named. And some images were captured, and they were published online on the New Scientist website. And they're very, very interesting. These copper fittings or metal fittings actually turn, they loop, and it appears that they go back into the block. And then there are some faint indications that there may be a cable coming from the top at the center of this block. So the other fascinating discovery that they made was these glyphs that were painted on the floor behind the Ganton Brinks door. And these glyphs, they are not hieroglyphs, and there has been no, when they first saw them, nobody knew what they were, and I think in the final analysis, they said that they were Mason's marks. And so we have these marks. There are three symbols and a line painted on the floor behind Ganton Brink's door. The center of the symbols shows a circle and a vertical line with two lines coming out like a stick figure, except without arms. On both sides of that symbol, that figure, there is another figure, but it looks like a number 5. And one it looks distinctly like a number 5. The other one, it's not as clear, but it looks like when it was originally painted, it could have been the number 5 also.
Huh.
So
how did somebody get in there? Isn't that small?
Well, it gets better. Because when you consider the design of these metal fittings or electrodes, as I describe them, it became obvious to me that they were actually designed so that they could be replaced. And when you look at the original Gantenbrink video, when they finally discovered those metal fittings, they were quite eroded, and one had actually broken off and was lying in the passage or in the shaft. So according to the Giza power plant theory, there would have been a corrosive chemical in the shaft, and it's quite likely that those metal fittings would have eroded over time and use, and eventually they would have had to have been replaced. And so the design of the Gantenbrink's door now is such that you could actually take those out and replace them with new ones.
That is
now, there's an article on my website that you can link to from the front page on the new exploration of the southern shaft in the Queen's Chamber. But I actually created a design that showed what those symbols mean and what the electrodes mean as far as their design, their use, and the symbols on the floor were nothing more than electronic symbols that showed people who came after how this machine was wired.
It's like a schematic almost, huh?
It's a schematic, absolutely. And the center figure is actually a cable. It shows a cable with a twisted pair coming out of it, quite clearly. The two figures on the side, the number five, those were connectors, and they connected with the metal fittings in the door, and then they attached to a central cable. And so now we have pretty much all the elements of how that piece of equipment functioned. And you might be interested to know that Ancient Aliens visited me a few weeks ago, and I demonstrated a model of the upper portion of the shaft with the Gantenbrink's door and the whole thing functioning as it was described in the Giza power plant.
As the years have gone by, Christopher, more convinced than ever that the Giza pyramids indeed power plants?
Yes, I am more convinced. I've always, until such time that somebody comes along and can explain everything that I've put in that book in terms of the evidence and how it fits cohesively and coherently in the theory, nobody has been able to do that yet. And then if they can predict how a thing functions or what may be found through further exploration, then it turns out to be different, then of course I would have to go back to the drawing board or disappear off the planet, one or the other.
Don't disappear on us.
But so far, everything that has been tested and everything that has been found actually supports the theory, which is remarkable. John Cadman, who I believe you know of, he proved that the subterranean chamber actually functioned like a pulse generator, which is what I described in the Giza power plant, that the priming pulses to bring the pyramid into resonance with the planet was started in the subchamber, and an engineer in Bellingham, Washington, actually demonstrated that.
All amazing stories, Christopher. We're going to come back with more phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.
Hey, you know that hormone balancing product we talked about before? The all natural one. Ambrin? Well, I gotta tell you this. Not only did Ambrin stop my hot flashes, but since I started the Ambrin program, I have lost so much weight. Seriously, even my belly fat, it's gone. I haven't been this thin in years. I feel great. Give me a call.
The leading cause of weight gain in women over 40 is hormonal imbalance. Until you balance your hormones, it can be practically impossible to lose weight. Ambrin restores hormonal balance naturally, so the weight can just fall off. Yes, even that stubborn belly fat. Plus, Ambrin eliminates other symptoms of hormonal aging too. So with your hormones in balance, you can feel great and finally lose the weight. Be one of the first 50 callers right now, and they'll send you a complimentary risk-free trial with a 30-day supply, free. Call 1-800-890-8766. That's 1-800-890-8766. 1-800-890-8766.
Brian, let me ask you first, of all these things that you've investigated, is there one area there that just fascinates you the most?
Yeah, I think the elongated skulls do, because I'm seeing correlations between them and the megalithic structures. Elongated skulls have been found in the Tiwanaku Pumapunku area around Cusco, Paracas. And what I'm finding is that the ancient road system, which connects all of these together, which most archaeologists believe were built by the Incas, are probably thousands of years old. So that's my major focus at the moment.
How about you, Christopher?
Well, Pumapunku resonates with me, being an engineer. But also the mysteries in Peru are also fascinating to me, the construction methods and how they could have actually performed that work. All of that is fascinating to me.
And, you know, what I find just watching both your works over the years, what is fascinating to me is the fact that this planet worldwide has similar technologies all around. And like you said earlier, Christopher, they had to have some form of communication, or they were all located strategically in one spot, and then they went all over the globe. Something happened.
Something definitely happened. And, you know, the idea that what is very positive about not just the ancient alien researchers, but also any researcher into finding the truth about our past. And there are many different ideas, but there's a lot of cooperation between us. I mean, you know, there is disagreement, but there's a lot of cooperation. And that is what's the most beautiful about this effort in this day and age. And the other thing is the number of young people who are actually resonating with these ideas now. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, the number of young people who have come up to me, contacted me. I was with some University of Illinois students the other last week, and one of them came up to me and said, "Hey, I saw you on television." I'm like, "Okay." He says, "Yeah, that was great. Big fan."
Yeah.
And this is an engineering student, right? So, you know, the young people are actually picking up on it. And you know, as far as the conventional theories about, you know, dumb old cavemen or people crafting all these marvelous forms with stone axes and dolerite pounders or whatever, it just doesn't wash anymore. So,
why do you think, Christopher, the fascination with all this?
Well, I think it's because it's a big question mark. It's just, you know, I mean, people are driven to know the truth. And if they think that there's a part of history that, you know, if they've been told a lie or they've been misinformed, I wouldn't say a lie because I'm not saying that anybody intentionally lies, but perhaps they're misinformed or they've been given incomplete information, then, you know, that gets their attention. They get very passionate about those things. I've known people who, you know, who watch Ancient Aliens, and they remark to me how they've learned so much from that. Even you know, if you take the alien agenda out of it, but the production values of the program and also the places that they have been to and shown the public that the general public just have not been aware of. I've seen places that blow me away on that show, and I just wasn't aware that they existed.
Me too. It is a widely watched television show, and I'm glad they're in their fourth year, and hopefully it'll be year five, too. You never know.
You just never know.
And, Brian, how about you? What fascinates you about this in that? Why do you think so many people are interested in this?
Well, I think it comes down to the essential question of who are we, where do we come from? And I agree with Chris. I wouldn't say that people have necessarily been lying about our past, but so many of these anomalies show up, such as the elongated skulls, the incredible precision that we know is ancient. And so I and others are trying to connect the dots, and that's why I'm so thankful to have a friendship and working relationship with Chris and with Lloyd Pye, with Stephen Mailer, with David Childress, with Graham Hancock, and others, because together we're putting the pieces together. You know, not one of us will do the whole thing, but I'm very thankful to have relationships with all of these great minds so that together, you know, we can help humanity hopefully remember who it is that we are and where we come from.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Let's take some calls. We'll go to, who's our first person? David in Lynchburg, Virginia. Welcome to the show. Hi, David.
Thank you very much, George. I'm going to be really quick. I'm really excited about tonight's show. It's really awesome. And my question is to Christopher of his thoughts and his take on Edley Scallions with Bill Coral Castle. What his thoughts are of how he possibly got a lot of the power plant theory right.
Okay, let you review that. Go ahead, Christopher.
Okay, in a nutshell, my thoughts on the matter have not changed since I wrote my book. I believe that what he was using was essentially related to what he wrote about, and he wrote about magnetism, and he wrote about electricity, and he had a different take than scientists on what the nature of magnetism and electricity was. So he believed that the Earth is streaming magnets, and that magnets are related to the magnetic field or pull is related to gravity. And if you would be able to reverse the polarity of one object and align both poles, then objects would push away from the Earth rather than be attracted to them. That was his mindset. I believe that he was able to strike the right note frequencies using a vibration and electromagnetic radiation. So he had elements of radio equipment in his tool shed, his tool room at Coral Castle. He actually had copper cables strung around the place in a grid at one time. And so those are some of the observations, and that you can see the spools of the copper cables in his tool shop. So he was definitely doing something, and it hit on the right combination of frequencies or some technique that he used that was able to lift the block. Does that answer your question, David?
And he believed, Christopher, that every object could have magnetism. It didn't have to be just metal, correct?
Right. He believed that all matter was actually made up of individual magnets, and that, you know, just the atoms in the materials are individual magnets, and this magnetic field streams from the Earth, and that objects are actually attracted by through magnetism, and that's essentially what we note as gravity. You know, one of the things that was an eye-opener for me, and it's just a way, a different way of looking at things, and, you know, it technically may be, not be correct, it scientifically may not be correct, but using that mindset, using that theory, he was able to accomplish something that nobody else has been able to accomplish. Unfortunately, he took the secret to the grave with him. But I definitely believe that, you know, there is a technique because, you know, what my mind was shifted one time when I asked the question, when I started talking about anti-gravity. And the person who was with me at the time said, well, what is anti-gravity? Describe anti-gravity. And at that moment, I realized that anti-gravity is any technique that we devise or can use in order to defeat the pull of gravity. So if you're looking for anti-gravity devices, you can look at airplanes, you can look at forklift trucks, even the human body when he gets out of bed in the morning is employing anti-gravity. So it's just the technique that we use to overcome it. And Ed Lee Scanlon, I believe, had developed a different technique.
Let's go to Julia in Utah. Welcome to the show. Hi, Julia.
I tried to talk to you for a long time. It's very hard. But anyway, I had this invitation that my boyfriend, he gave me a long time ago about you. And I listened for 4 years already.
Well,
I'm a student. I was taking a lot of archaeology classes in Utah. And I understood the conversation between those two archaeologists, you know, you have now, they're getting close to the relation between the Phoenicians, you know, culture. Mm-hmm. Because where my grandpa, he was telling me, because he was archaeology, he was telling me that 10,000 years ago, the Phoenicians, they come to Peru, and was the who now that we know is the Incas and the architect and all the influence that we had, it was close with the Egyptians through the Mesopotamia because we putting all together the pieces and we getting close with all the culture. And it's very hard to explain how the relation is, but if we look in the Quechua Aymara, it's a dialect coming from the Hebrews with the Chinese and Japanese.
All right, well, let's get Brian's take on the Phoenicians coming over to that area of Peru. What do you think, Brian?
I think it's possible. What I really think is that because the Inca themselves, we don't exactly know where they came from. I think we're talking several thousand years of different people mixing and blending.
Right.
For example, with the Olmec people, you know, that's a very small part of Mexico, and David Childress and other people have theorized that because where the Olmecs lived was such a narrow area between the Atlantic and Pacific. That was an excellent little land bridge for people to not only cross from one ocean to the other, but also racially blend. So that's why you have the African head showing up. You have Chinese-looking heads showing up. And living in Peru, you know, I see people who are native. Some look Hawaiian. Some look Japanese. So I think we're talking about at least, you know, more than 10,000 years of people traveling around the planet, racially mixing. Quechua and Aymara are related languages, but their origins are very speculative. Some people say, you know, that there are aspects of, from India. Some people say Egypt. We just don't know. I think our history is so rich that it'll take a long time to get to the bottom of it.
Let's go to Mike, truck driving in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program. Hi, Mike.
Hello, George, Chris. Good evening.
Hi.
I'd like to make a comment about lasers, and then I'd like to offer you a possible new construction on the pyramid.
Okay.
Chris, I believe you said we don't have any control over laser death.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
How do they control the lasers when they take that acrylic block and they take a picture and put it in there with lasers? They have to have some type of control over the depth.
I understand what you're saying. No, essentially, when you're inscribing inside a piece of Lexan, it is the focal point that raises the temperature of the plastic to a level that it melts. And so what you see is very minute bubbles on the inside of the block. But the light actually passes through it. Let me clarify that a little bit. Taken without the interference of any material, you cannot set the depth of a laser. You can set the focal length, but light is going to shine into the distance. Not like a conventional tool, which you can set the depth very precisely. And so it's the geometric forms that are precisely cut to a certain depth that cannot be done with lasers.
All right, Michael, you have a follow-up. Go ahead.
Yes. You're both familiar with the 3D printers?
What if they
use a laser, the hologram, whatever it is they want to design, and then they use stone powder and fill it with a 3D laser, with a 3D printer, I mean?
Well, again, I mean, yes, you can use the laser to etch and to affect changes in any kind of material. And so if you're looking at a laser to etch or to sinter material onto something else, then you can very precisely control it with modern equipment using folding mirrors, driving mirrors, marking lasers, just kind of etch the surface of a tombstone. But precisely setting a depth and machining out or cutting out something that is, I would say, you know, between 6 and 12 inches deep with a laser, I would say that is an impossibility.
Christopher, if you were a witness to the pyramids being built, speculate for a moment on how you think they cut those blocks and then moved them.
Well, my speculation has been started in the Giza power plant, actually, in advanced machining in ancient Egypt, that the one of the better methods for actually removing material and controlling the removal of material and creating precise forms is ultrasonic machining. And so, you know, that is something that we use in industry today, and it's used to machine shapes in very, very hard materials like carbides and ceramics and even granite. So that material, that method, when I look at some of the complex geometry in Egypt and in South America, it would seem to me that that technology would be almost necessary to create some of the artifacts that I've seen. And particularly when we look at the statues in Egypt, and you can actually see tool paths where a tool has cut along a particular path. They leave striations, they leave witness marks. And in some areas, they actually drive the tool just a little deeper than the surrounding rock. And so those little signature marks indicate that a tool was being guided very precisely across the surface of the rock.
Gosh, I would have loved to have been there. We're going to be back in a moment with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.
Now you can take Coast to Coast AM with you on your iPhone. Get the latest headlines, listen to the show, and play the exclusive alien abduction game. Download the app directly from the App Store or visit coasttocoastam.com to learn how.
effective at improving joint health. New Schiff Move Free Ultra. More effective than two regular glucosamine and chondroitin in just one little pill. Why? Because it's a breakthrough 2-in-1 formula with hyaluronic acid plus type 2 collagen to activate your own immune system and help repair joint cartilage. It's based on a 90-day human clinical study. Move on to something more effective. New Move Free Ultra.
You know that 2:30 feeling? You've hit the wall, but you got to get stuff done? That's the time to take 5-Hour Energy. You'll get the alert, energized feeling you need to get stuff done. A lot of stuff. 5-Hour Energy, when you gotta get stuff done.
Want to energize your workplace? Then sign up for an energy break. Your workplace will be given plenty of free 5-Hour Energy by friendly, knowledgeable representatives. Go to energybreaknow.com to sign up. It's fast and easy, just like 5-Hour Energy. Do it today.
And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, with our two guests, Brian Forrester, Christopher Dunn. We're going to have your final phone calls in just a moment. Christopher, in terms of new research into any of this, besides folks like you and David Hatcher-Childress and Brian, anybody else doing any cutting-edge research?
I think there's many people out there who are doing very valuable work. And the, I mean, there are too numerous to mention. If I miss one, I won't want to offend anybody. But you know, I think the work of Stephen Mailer in Egypt is very valuable. Of course, there are many others. The Robert Val, Graham Hancock have done great work. I'm very impressed with Brian Forrester and his work. He's actually done more to bring the civilization in South America to the public than anybody that I've known in the past. I mean, I've, in terms of bringing it to the general public, I know that there's been valuable work done by past researchers, but Brian has worked tirelessly. He lives there. He's not just a accidental tourist who goes there on a holiday and comes back and scratches his head over it. He is working on the ground all the time. And that's one of the main reasons that I elected to do a tour with Brian, because he has the heart of the Peruvian people, and he respects the oral tradition and the indigenous people. So that is very important to me. So, he's a maniac on Facebook, George. You ought to see some of his videos. They're incredible. Obviously there's more coming up. You know, there are new researchers all the time. So I think it's a very rich and, very rich and vibrant field that we're in. Certainly we're not dying. We have been attacked very heavily by the opposition, obviously, over the years. Sure. But, the subject just doesn't die, and the attacks are more, don't offer anything valuable as far as explanation for our questions, so we just keep on asking the questions and gathering more data.
And Brian, what do you think of the Nazca lines, which are, of course, the basis for Eric von Däniken's Chariot of the Gods?
Well, I'm very fortunate in that being in Paracas, which is right next to Nazca, I'm the assistant director of the Paracas History Museum, and my great teacher is Dr. Juan Navarro. And his theory, because he's the world expert on Paracas, is that the animal figures and the lines are completely different. What he believes, through complete logic, is that the Nazca made the lines because it's such an arid, dry part of the world, that what they were doing is mapping the underground water systems. So it really has nothing to do with aliens. And that the animal figures are actually at least 1,000 years older, and they were designed by and built by the Paracas people, who were predominant in the area. The Paracas took up a huge area of land, and they were absorbed into the more warfaring Nazca people who came later. So the elongated skull culture, who were the Paracas, in the archaeological record, they disappear about 2,000 years ago and are replaced by the Nazca. So it's a very complex field, but I think Senior Juan Navarro's logic makes a lot of sense.
All right, let's go back to the calls. We'll go to JW in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the program. Hi, JW.
Oh, hi, George. Hey, thanks for having me on. I had to miss about 20, 30 minutes of the show, so I hope I'm not repeat anything. But I have to tell you about this guy in Michigan. He's an old retired construction worker. His name is Wally Wallington. I saw a video on him the other day, and he is moving stones by himself with nothing but wood. And these stones are 40 tons. He's making a Stonehenge. He's making a replica of Stonehenge. He stood on this video. I saw him stand a 40-ton stone straight up in the air and drop it into the hoe using leverage and wood. And if they use that type of maybe that's why the tools down in South America, why they're not finding any tools, is maybe they're disintegrated like maybe they use wood like Wally is doing. And I just wanted to say that I think that the pyramids are they were made by men. I don't believe they were made by anybody other than men, but just a lot of hard work. Because I ran the numbers and I researched. I did some research on this a couple of months ago when you had another guest on it. And I ran the numbers on this. And it said that when they were building them pyramids, that they had only had to lay about 250 stones a day. And I think I looked at three different experts. The experts said that as many as 200,000 men worked on those pyramids. And I just don't think that's too much for 200,000 men to lay in one day, because
I don't know how 200,000 men could get their hands and arms in the same same area to pull these blocks and move these blocks. But you're right. I've seen the Wally videos, and he's moving them.
Yeah, but the 250 stones a day. I looked at the three experts. One expert said 20,000 men. One expert said 30,000 men. Another one said 200,000 men. But if you take the quarries were only 4 miles on the other side of the Nile, and the pyramid is only 1 mile on the opposite side of the pyramid than the quarries. So they really just had to move those stones 4 miles to a boat, ship them up the Nile, and then move them another mile to the pyramid. And on top of that, only 95% of the stone in the pyramids were just limestone, and they only weighed about 2 or 3 tons apiece. And the other 5% was the heavy granite, the 50-100-ton granite that had to be moved to 50 miles.
Well, but, with the 250 blocks a day, though, and if they were working around the clock, they'd have to move 10 of those blocks an hour, those tonnage of blocks an hour. Let's get Christopher's take on this. What do you think of these, Christopher?
Well, I did enjoy Wally Wallington's video. I have seen it, and I found it very interesting. The granite blocks in the above the King's Chamber weigh 70 tons. They were brought 500 miles from Aswan. So that's a significant challenge. I think everybody has a preference in terms of how they look at ancient cultures and what the evidence speaks to them. And I actually lean towards Lee Scanlon, who, if there were only 4,500 Ed Lee Scanlons, he would have built the pyramid in 20 years, the time that it took him to build Coral Castle. So that's a very small workforce using his technique. But Wally's done great work, definitely somebody to admire, and certainly somebody who is looking for the simplest method to do the simplest movements, then Wally's the guy, that's for sure.
Well, and under JW's thoughts, that you'd have to move a block every 6 minutes.
Well, it's not just Yeah, it's not just that part of it, though, but, you know, it's also some of the inaccessible areas where they were actually putting these blocks, such as there is a lintel block down in the passageway of the Khafre's pyramid, the second pyramid, and it was taken down the length of this passageway and then lifted up into position so that you have to pass under it when you go into the chamber down below. And so, you know, I mean, there are a lot of construction problems involved in the pyramids that I personally don't think Wally's methods actually satisfy. So, but, you know, I'm not going to dismiss it. I mean, there's a lot there to be considered. And, I think actually going to Egypt and going into some of those areas and seeing some of the difficulty involved in doing that work is a very important part of anybody's studies and research.
First-time caller in Elko, Nevada. Hey, Chris, thank you.
You're welcome.
There we go.
Time caller. I've got a unique perspective on things I wanted to share with you guys. I currently work with a truck that recently lost its title as the largest truck in the world. The new champion is only capable of hauling about 40 tons more. The reason that we use these trucks is because the key to efficiency, as we all know, is the most possible work with the fewest steps. I've thought about this for years and years since I was a little kid, and I've got an interesting theory that answers a lot of these questions that are unanswerable with the pyramids of Giza. If one stone were drug over there and chipped down in pyramid shape, and then squares were carved on it for aesthetic reasons, I mean, you can have 80 million people on it at the same time to relocate that stone. And I've always been curious if the great mystery of the pyramids is that it's 1, 3, or maybe even only 5 stones, as opposed to as many stones as we think it is. I think if you were to carve the shape of individual stones on one solid piece, it would explain why you can only go so far in there and no longer get between the stones, as well as with one piece, you can get as many people as you possibly wanted to relocate that one stone. And, I wanted to hear Christopher's thoughts on that.
Okay.
That when you go to Egypt and you go to the Giza Plateau and walk around, it's very obvious that all the pyramids are made out of individual stones, and they're clearly defined. If you walk around the Khafre's pyramid, which is the second largest pyramid on the Giza Plateau, you'll find that some of those blocks have been stripped away, and they used that place like a quarry in ancient times. You can see where the ancient Romans were slicing off pieces of granite, but they're definitely made out of individual elements, and it's estimated that in the Great Pyramid there's about 2.3 million blocks of stone.
Next up, we go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's Peter's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
How are you? Dr. Good, Bruce Peter. Goldberg is an expert in time travel. Why not ask him to go back in time and see how they did it?
Or remote viewing. Maybe we should do that, too. That could be, too. You never know. Next up, we'll go to Bill in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hello, Bill. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, I took care of a gentleman some years ago, and he said that he had been into the caves up in the mountains in Peru, and there was machines and equipment in there that was made of metals, not of this earth. And so he figured that the aliens had put them there. What's your take on that?
Well, the old extraterrestrial theory. Who wants it? Brian?
I haven't heard anything about that. Again, what I'm trying to do is like what Stephen and Chris and others have found in the Cairo Museum, where you have these artifacts which seem to be precisionly made, like perfect bowl shapes with even fins on them. The Egyptologists label them as being fruit plates or something, but clearly they were machine parts, and that's what I'm trying to explore in Peru, is trying to find artifacts like that that seem to be machine components so that people like Chris can theoretically reassemble them. But in terms of aliens and alien technology, the people in the Highlands see UFOs all the time, but in terms of actual finding of machines, I've heard nothing of that.
Chris, what about the Baghdad Battery? Any significance here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly has drawn a lot of attention because the ancients were supposedly they weren't considered to have known about electricity, let alone had a device. From my own perspective, though, it seems like it's a fairly primitive device, and when you compare it to the Great Pyramid is head and shoulders, both in size and functionality in terms of the electrical nature of it.
All right, we've got one or two more calls, and that'll be it. We go to Yuma, Arizona. Kelly, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
I have a question for Christopher.
Sure.
Since Dr. Hawass is no longer involved, is anyone going to be allowed to get into the chamber under the legs of the Sphinx?
That's a very good question, Kelly. I think it may actually become even more difficult. One of the things with Hawass was that he was very close to the Edgar Cayce Foundation. And
yeah.
And so a lot of the explorations and digs and that were taking place were funded by the Edgar Cayce Foundation, and they had a close relationship with Hawass. Now with the Islamic Brotherhood gaining in prominence, the move is to actually be less open and progressive in terms of exploration, particularly if that exploration is going to reveal something that would alter the Egyptian history. So it's very delicate right now, and it's hard to say whether Hawass being removed is actually going to help the situation or not, in my opinion.
Brian, would you give us your website, please?
Yes, it's www.hiddenincatours.com.
Very good. And Christopher, which one do I still keep using? The GizaPower.com. GizaPower.com. Is that the one?
That is the one. www.gizapower.com.
Keep in touch with us, both of you, and let us know of any new discoveries. Christopher Dunn, Brian Forrester, thank you so much, both of you. Their websites, of course, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, and also their works, great books. One of Brian's, The Enigma of Cranial Deformation. It's about those elongated skulls. Christopher's, of course, The Giza Power Plant and Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. You've got both of those. And on our next program, we're going to talk a little bit about the devil. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.